All right.
But first, I was going to talk about the centrist thing. Now, you and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and I should open this by saying there has this is a strange thing to say out of the blue. there has been a documentary made about me, and it's on YouTube. It's not an official sort of, it's not a TV station or production company that have made this. It's a guy and working on his own, and he's a sort of centrist, and he's definitely not on our side. He did approach me with some questions, and I answered him. So I was able to establish that he's definitely not, you know, one of us. And you can see from the documentary itself that he made that he's not one of us. And that in time, and I'll link people to it since it's come up. Hold on a second. Let me just get this this link for people.
Just while you're doing that, I'll just say for the chat quickly, the movie I was talking about was Scott of the Antarctic from 1948 with John Mills. I would just buy that, and you'll rekindle your heroic British spirit. Or Norwegian, or, you know, Northern European, essentially. It doesn't matter.
Just trying to find this bloody link. But, yeah, people might want to see. I haven't said anything about it yet, and I will link people to it from my Telegram. But in the meantime, here it is. Here's the link if people want to watch it. It's an interesting indication of how the centre views this movement. Let's put it that way. So there's the link. I've just put it in there. But Morgoth and I were discussing this, and I should emphasize that what we're going to say here is not really a dig at the guy who made this documentary, but it is a note on the mentality, that the culture that he seems to be part of, which is that of the political centrist. Because in the documentary, he sort of makes light of my predictions of a civil war in Europe, even though he himself has said that it's a possibility. I mean, he said that to me, but nonetheless, he makes light of it. And I was sort of amazed and aghast. I couldn't understand, how can someone be casual about this? I mean, mass immigration of Africans and Arabs, Middle Easterners into Europe in like huge numbers. How is that? I mean, how can you make light of the idea that that could result in violence and civil unrest, even civil war? Now, I want to say, I'm not saying that I want that to happen. I don't want war. I don't want violence. I'm not advocating violence. I'm simply saying, when you mix these two peoples together, or more than two, really, but when you mix them together, force them to coexist, there is going to be conflict. That's just sort of inevitable. So there's this whole side of it that the centrist today has to deny the effects of progressivism, what it's doing to us and to our societies. But the other part of it, the other side of it, is that the centrist also has to deny the other thing that's coming in, which is the tyranny, because that also doesn't fit with their liberal worldview. So you've got this weird situation where, and this is why I'm glad that our movement does not have an enforced ideology, because it enables us to be free enough to comment on these things. There are some people in our movement who are so in love with the state and the idea of state power that they didn't, they were not inclined to take a certain position on COVID, for example. Whereas people like you and Morgoth and I were able to comment on that freely. So, but the centrist is in this weird position where he can't comment on either thing. He can't comment on, or he can't take a position on either thing. He's his only, like, whether it's the tyranny or the progressivism, he has to straddle this. And his only option is to say, well, I hope the status quo continues, even with the forces of progressivism, mass immigration, multiculturalism, Islam. I hope that we remain liberal. Even with the forces of tyranny, the digital ID, the surveillance, even with all of that, I hope we remain liberal. But he can't really do anything to maintain liberalism in the face of these two forces. So, and yet the centrist seems to be unable to wake up to that reality. It's just hope. It's just hoping for the best against all likelihood. And what I noted about this documentary is it's made in this style of Chris Morris. And I believe, I mean, it seems likely to me that the guy is a big fan of Chris Morris and the Brass Eye Jam from the 90s and 2000s. But the thing is, that is obsolete now. That mentality is gone now. It no longer fits with the world as it is today. Now, the world as it is today is in flux. It's in motion. And as I say, there are these two very different forces going on at once, and they're coordinated as well. I don't think that it's two separate things. But the point is that the world is in motion now, in a big, big way. And yet the centrist just has to sort of hope for the best in all of this, and keep harking back to a time, the 90s, the 2000s, where things weren't like this. There wasn't so much confusion. There wasn't so much ambiguity about what the future would hold. There was a sense that the end of history, the Cold War's over, and now we can just be consumers, and cultures change, like pop culture's changing all the time. Films are changing all the time. There's endless innovation. It's all just comfy. We're safe. And then, of course, 9/11 happened in 2001, and put an end to that. Now, the 2000s sort of maintained it in a certain way for another 10 years. Then the SJW thing started in the 2010s, the start of a new doctrine, a new orthodoxy. And then in 2020, COVID happened, and you've got this globalist tyranny starting. So it's weird to see something made about me when I've been trying to grapple with these contemporary issues, and yet this documentary seems to be viewing me, or attempting to view me, from the vantage point of the year 2000. So Morgoth, do you want to take over there?
Yeah, because the centrists, I was saying to you that it's weird, because it seems like that, all right, so it's a sort of tee-hee-hee, look at what the fringe are saying, and sort of leaving something controversial that you said just kind of hanging there. And he did this all of the time. And so this is a sort of way of saying, it's like a sort of a nod and a wink, as if to say, well, look what the crazies are saying. But the problem is, like, he what is he actually appealing to? As a sort of a centrist, he's appealing to the idea that fundamentally, society is sound, and that he is like the center is fun, is okay, it is rock solid. Now, you may have some crazy outliers here or there, but by and large, and you, like, say we would be one of those crazy outliers, other crazy outliers, or what they used to call the SJWs, or perhaps Islamic extremists, and this kind of thing. So what they are doing is adopting this kind of smug attitude, as if to say, well, look at what the fringe, look at what the outliers have to say. Look at these outrageous things they're coming out with. But the problem is, and the problem stems from how toothless they were, so the establishment has always been corrupt, and it wanted to be subverted by these forces. But even then, in a sort of just objectively, when you look at their value system, they didn't have anything in there to use to shut people down, to get rid of people, because they had all of these liberal priors. And so what's ended up is that they've ended up themselves being ousted from that smug centrist position. The center now is the woke tranny stuff. It is the anti-white stuff. It is Google kind of shelving white men who wrote historical novels, you know, that we discussed. So what I say is it isn't him. And he seems to take that for granted. They all did. They all did back in 2015. They all assumed that, yeah, it may get a little bit rocky, but there's a sort of balancing mechanism at the heart of the society and culture and politics that would kind of right it. You know, the ship wouldn't get tossed. It may get tossed around a bit, but it'll stay afloat. The good ship liberalism will carry on. The problem is that's just not the case anymore. It's mass censorship and hate campaigns, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And I don't see what right he has to adopt that smug attitude, because he can't appeal to the centre anymore. The centre now is the rainbow flag and men dressed up in leather acting like dogs and like forced vaccinations, all this shit. So that mindset that they had is itself now dated. Like, that time has passed. And you can look at that, like, even the style of the editing seems kind of dated. This, because it's based on a set of assumptions that everybody will get it, that everybody will be comfortable, and they'll think, well, you know, it'll work itself out in the end. But it hasn't. It hasn't done that. You've got young boys who are being, like, brainwashed into cutting their dicks off. This isn't sane. If this is going to right itself, if the kind of the smug attitude is based on the idea that it's all going to work out in the end, like Candide and Voltaire, the best of all possible worlds, when's that actually going to kick in? When are we going to see that happening? And how is it going to happen? Is it going to happen without censoring people or jailing people? Because they wouldn't be up for that either. So it's just this kind of deluded arrogance and a hubris, which is completely based on nothing. It's got no substance to it. I mean, even the ones that were around at that time, somebody like Sargon, you know, with all the back and forths over the years that used to happen, even he's like jumped ship. Even he's like more of a reactionary and much more right-wing conservative than he used to be. Because that's the place where he was, and he was probably the best at it, was just untenable. And now in 2022, there's somebody going to come along and kind of try and do it all over again, and it just looks stupid. It just looks really dated.
Another one would be Paul Joseph Watson. He used to be, you know, what we call a centrist, and now he's quite frequently talking about the anti-white thing. Yeah, he's just taking it as a given, and of course these guys can take it as a given because the alt-right established it 5-7 years ago. But that's by the by. It's been established. It's clearly the case. It's obvious. It's happening every single day. So we're not in the 90s anymore. Now you and I have a lot of nostalgia for the 90s. We came of age then. It was fun. It was a great decade in a lot of ways. So I think we can both understand the nostalgia for it, the fondness for it. But it is the past. I mean, it's actually a long time ago now. You know, it's 1992 is literally 30 years ago.
Like that whole sort of Mr. Metega thing where you kind of laugh and as the world burns, I think that as a kind of form, which I always thought was hilarious, some of the, especially the Croton Tea Wars, if you remember them, I remember that the year that he puts them videos out.
I remember them. I was part of it. That was 2017. Yeah,
that was so funny. But even that, it's a bit more nihilistic and anarchic. The problem is, like, what is an anarchist or a nihilist? What is their response to having, like, actual chaos in all of the halls of government and then running all of the institutions where it isn't this kind of abstract thing that you can use to kind of be fun and, you know, and deconstruct things? Now, well, no, where you are, like, the chaotic force. What happens when the chaotic force is the system itself, because yes, that's where we are.
Yes, yes. And that's an interesting thing about Chris Morris and the Brass Eye, that was really pillorying an establishment that was already dead and pretty much gone in a lot of ways. It didn't attack the new Labour era, that the managerialism, the shallowness, the political correctness at all, as far as I can remember. It was really attacking the old establishment that was already supplanted, already gone. So it's not surprising that that centrist mindset has no way to attack the new Labour era, or what we now are living through, everything that's happened since 1997, right? The centrist doesn't really have a way to critique it. All he can say is, well, it's going a bit too fast. Like, it's kraut and tea. I mean, what can he really say about mass immigration other than, oh, it's happening too fast? Let's slow it down a wee bit. I'm okay with us being bred out. I'm okay with multiculturalism. I'm not racist. Just slow it down a bit.
Even
that's all they can say.
I mean, that this when you talk about the centrists, it is not just them and their politics, but also this idea that fundamentally the center would remain intact, and that, like you say, would be the center of the 90s or maybe the 80s if they want to be like a bit more edgy. And so what you have is people who give takes on movies and whatnot on Movie Critic YouTube, which I pay attention to a bit. And basically, they are like 90s liberals. But there's like this whole culture war going on because they are now, from the systems, like from the actual center's point of view, they are far right now. They are like proper reactionaries because they are saying you don't get black dwarves and you don't get, you know, Galadriel wasn't a warrior princess and all this kind of thing. So it's like they have become like the far right just by having the same opinions for the last 20 years.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're like 10 years behind us. They're noticing this stuff now. They're probably, I would guess, still not seeing the significance of it, probably desperately trying not to see the significance of it. But
I mean, I've kind of criticized them in the past, but I've been quite impressed with how far they're going. Well, they don't have a choice because they're on the chopping block along with the rest of us, and they know it. It's just that their particular niche is movies and nerd culture and stuff like that, which is kind of I get it. It's like a war with lots of different fronts, and we're losing on all of the fronts. It just so happens that they've got their own particular one, but you know, it's not to be sneered at because the system is so formalized now, consolidated, that when you are kind of, if you're attacking, say, the shitty new Tolkien thing or you know, the whatever, the new crap Obi-Wan or whatever it is, like that seems like weak tea. But fundamentally, they are attacking the same system as the rest of us. They are critiquing. It's just like a sort of different tentacle of it in the cultural sphere. Whereas Because all of these, it all plays into the sort of the ESG and this interconnected network of finance. It dominates everything. It dominates politics. It dominates more and more the public health, for example, which is a much more serious problem with it. But then it's also the entertainment industry. It's also how you do Google searches. It's everything. And so they are in the end attacking the same thing, but I wouldn't used to see it like that. We would used to see it as being a different thing. It was something separate. Politics, and certainly public health. Like public health would not be considered part of like a culture war, but it is now. Everything is. Everything's been politicized.
And another
thing with the centrist is that this kind of politicization of everything is what's cooked them, because the idea is you have a distance and an individualism which is not directly connected or influenced by others. You make up your own mind as an individual and all of this. And we see now that's long gone. What does the centrist have to say in the age of applied psychology and nudge departments to get people on board with whatever narratives the system wants? Like, what is the centrist response to that? What is the centrist response when there's a terrorist attack in Manchester and like 22 young white girls get blown to pieces by a Muslim with a nail bomb, and then there's this kind of in place propaganda campaign to make sure people don't get angry about it, which is ruled out. They've got them now. If there was a bomb went off somewhere on the London Underground or something tonight, they've already got in place a PR campaign to bring out against that. If it was somebody on the far right who did it, they'd have such and such a narrative to spin, which would be brutal for us. If it was turned out to be a Muslim, then they would have something which was a bit more touchy-feely. The point is that if the masses are just cajoled and manipulated to this degree, then their agency has been removed. And this, again, is devastating for us, kind of centrist liberalism, because nobody is making up their own mind. Nobody is being an individual.
No, and indeed. Just to use a concrete example, the centrist who writes a novel, he's a white guy, and the novel, he cannot have a career as a novelist because it's been decided. So yeah. he is an individual pursuing his individual dream of being a novelist. Well, he's fucked. His individual dream is nothing in the face of the machine.
Yeah, and there would have to be a new government and a policy in place to do something about that. What do you want to take Google on? But they're a private company. So it's just out of date. So the idea that you can kind of sit back and kind of smugly kind of say, look at these crazies. No, pal, you're in the same shit as the rest of us.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There is no room for complacency. Complacency is naivety. That's the thing. It's something that's so difficult to impress upon people. This is not 1995 anymore. This is not 2005 anymore. It's not even 2015. And that was bad enough. But it's not even that. We've gone quite considerably further than that now. And the idea that you can just laugh about all of this or make a doc, and I should say the documentary is not entirely against me. It's sympathetic to me as a person, but I just want to make that clear. He's not vicious about me. He could have been a lot more ruthless than he is, but nonetheless, he does approach it from a position that this is all a bit of a lark. There are these guys online who think something's really serious in the world. Ha ha! Imagine that. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, and I even said this to him. I said, do you realize that there are 1,500 girls in Rotherham who got raped or sexually assaulted by Pakistani Muslims? The estimate was originally 1,400. It's since been increased to 1,500. At least it's going to, the reality will probably be much worse than that, but let's just say 1,500 in one town. How bad does it have to get before you will take this current situation seriously and honestly appraise the prospects for the future for a white girl growing up in that same town 10 years from now? Is it going to be fucking sweetness and light, or is something brutal going on in the world now?
I mean, I have to remember as well, like, say 2017, 2016, we were talking about numbers, demographics, we were talking about the JQ, talking about the sort of grooming gangs, and what tends to get forgotten these days is just the sheer amount of bloody terrorist attacks that were going on for a while back then. But these were all real and tangible things. But it never crossed our minds that Google would just hide like white men who'd written books. It's much, much worse than what I thought it would be. We didn't even expect to get censored off YouTube.
No.
Well, I haven't. But that's because I'm really careful and I rarely post on there now.
Touch wood. I mean, that's something that amazes me now. You know, when I find myself, it's like a guy who, I don't know, he was driving really fast and now he crashed and he's lost a leg and he's having to tell the story and he's saying, yeah, I somehow just didn't foresee the possibility that I would have a crash. So I was going at 120 miles an hour and it just wasn't obvious to me that this could happen. You know, that's how I feel now when I say I didn't ever think that they would just shut down your YouTube channel. It really just did not seem in 2014. I mean, it did happen then, but you had to be a complete, filming with a webcam in your garage with a swastika banner in the background and talking about certain ethnic groups in a distinctly unsavory fashion. Yeah, that's how far you had to go in order to get your channel shut down back then. And even then, you could just create a new one. There wasn't this thing about the lifetime ban, which now is the case with PayPal, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram. It's you as a person. It's not your profile. It's you. You, as a man, are no longer welcome on this platform in theory, for the rest of your life. So, what can I say? In 2014, I wouldn't have believed, I don't think. If someone had said to me, this is what it's going to be like in just a few short years from now, don't know if I would have believed them.
Like, so I've been banned from PayPal and I've been banned from Twitter a few times. I've been banned from Patreon. I've been more lucky. Well, really, YouTube's all I've got. I've done a lot of blogging as well, where it tends to be less severe. But what's interesting is that if you bring digital IDs into it, and because the reason that they'll say that they've banned you from YouTube or Twitter is because you broke terms and conditions, and those terms and conditions will be hate speech. It will be
you violated policy, and that's the end of the matter.
Yeah, but the point is they had a policy. Now, your digital ID will detect that. Your digital ID will know that you've been banned from this particular platform for violating policy. Now, they won't actually, the algorithm won't question the policy itself, but they will know that you violated the policy of a major tech firm. So this is not going. So this is going to be in your digital ID. This is what's coming, you know. And people say that, you know, don't talk about it. It matters. It really matters, all this stuff.
I was, last year, while this stuff was all quite new to me in the aftermath of COVID, you know, I spent last year with the Gram of Woes format, really analysing all of this and thinking about possibilities. Some things have come to pass, some things haven't. Some things I still expect in the future will come to pass. And so, you know, back then I was thinking about this and I was thinking, you know, it could be that you know, your account, your universal digital ID has a certain number of black marks on it. And any scanning device doesn't necessarily know what those black marks were for. It just knows that you're a guy with a lot of black marks. And that could be, that might be all it needs to know. So you're not getting into this supermarket. We've got a policy and we're a private company, so don't bother complaining. We can do what we like. So we have a policy that anyone with more than 5 black marks cannot shop here. And so you get 5 black marks for, I don't know, racism or something, but then the other shoppers don't know why you're being rejected. So for all they know, you could be a child molester. It doesn't make any difference to the system. It's really just a means of social control. So everything could get mixed up together in that way. And again, this is entirely speculative. I don't know that this is going to happen. I have no idea whether this will happen. I'm just saying it's very possible. Because again, the only objective for them is maximum social control. So if they can make being a racist as, and again, I use that word ironically, because I don't believe in the concept, but nonetheless, if they can make a racist be treated socially like a child molester, well, then who the hell is going to start going on to Telegram groups and channels at that point? They've basically made it impossible for you to live a functional life unless you are absolutely normie in all of your decisions, all of your choices in your everyday life.
It's a social credit system. I watched I did sometimes on me Substack, I do like a solo podcast where something's just caught my eye and I'll have a bit of a ramble on it. And a video caught my eye a while ago of something happened in China. I've probably spoke about this before, and if you're signed up me Substack, you'll know exactly what I'm going to say here. And it was a big super, like a mall, a shopping mall or something, somewhere in Shanghai or something. And I saw a video on Telegram, and what had happened, so what I saw on this video was just this frenetic stampede of Chinese people just desperately trying to get out of the shopping mall. The doors were smashed. The security guard was trying to hold them in place. Women were screaming. It was chaos, absolute pandemonium. And I thought, what the hell has gone on here? And I looked into a little bit more. And now what had happened was, so they've had these strict COVID sort of policies for so long, and they are now all logged onto these digital things. They've all got their Huawei phones or whatever. And now if your phone is green, you're okay, you're fine. If it's red, then you've been in contact with somebody who's got COVID, and you've got to hand yourself in. That's the thing, they'll know. So what had happened was somebody's phone at the start of the queue had suddenly turned red, which meant that they had either got COVID or they had passed somebody recently who had COVID. Now here's the problem. They are in a crowded sort of shopping mall surrounded by other people, and there's queues. So the person behind that person noticed that their phone had gone red, and then they panic because they are then in contact with that person. Because what this means is that you're getting shipped off to quarantine, you're getting things shoved up your nose and tests put on you and all of this. You've got to hand yourself into the men in white hazmat suits. So then the person behind them panicked, pulled out their phone. I don't know exactly what happened, but you can
a chain reaction.
So now everybody wants to get away from the person. It's too late, of course, because you've already been there. So even if your phone doesn't turn red straight away, it's going to turn red, you know, eventually. So then everybody, it starts a stampede, and everybody just wants to get away, like a fight or flight kind of thing. Just get away from the danger. The security guard recognizes what's going on, and he thinks, well, my job's on the line, because now I've got potentially 200 people inside of this store. And they will all be there. All their phones will be turning red soon as well. So then let's just say that you get outside. You get out of the store. Then you're outside. You go to, firstly, the algorithm means that they all know where you are. So the central system knows that you've been there. It knows that. Then you try and get on a bus to just get home as quickly as possible. Problem that you've got is that if your phone turns red, it could also shut off your funds. You can't, if it's a digital ID, your digital wallet, and your phone suddenly turns red, then the man and the hazmat suits are on their way, and they don't want you to move anymore because you're going to start and infect more people. So now automatically your bank account shuts down and you just got to stand there. So you try and get on a bus to go away. You can't do it because you can't pay. You run through the streets and it's just more trouble because all you're doing is having this knock-on effect. This is what's on the way. This is already exists in China.
I mean, COVID was just a gift.
And people have pulled me up and saying, oh, well, you know, what happened to that? It's not here, is it? The problem is the process which is bringing it about is here.
Yeah, definitely. And all it would take is another respiratory illness that's, you know, airborne, and the same that whole apparatus would whiz into gear, and it's been built, it's been developed now, so it's ready, presumably, or it will be very soon. So this is something of very serious concern, because again, now I know that someone could say, well, but it's for the public health. It's in a good cause. How can you be against it? But COVID, the survival rate was 99.6, and yet they were prepared to do all of that for that. Yeah, they were prepared to do all of the lockdowns and the social distancing, the curfews, whatever it was, a certain distance you were allowed to travel from your home, a certain number of people you were allowed to have in your home. They were willing to do all of that for a disease with 99.6% survival. And there are some people who think that even that would have been much higher if they'd allowed ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine to be used. So the point is that if even a disease like COVID-19, which is pretty damn mild, if even that can legitimize what's happened over the last 2 years, then it's not going to be long before a similar disease emerges. And of course, in the meantime, we've got the fun of the variants to contend with. So, I mean, I'm not saying that COVID is in full flow. Obviously, it's died down. And yet, obviously, they're not quite letting go of it. They're just bringing out a new vaccine now. And obviously, they're not going to put all of that infrastructure to waste. They've developed it. They're not going to just throw it away now. I mean, it's like the cliche about the government doesn't give up powers willingly or easily that it's accrued during a crisis. So I don't know what else to say, but sorry, go on.
Just one little point. That I met up with a couple of lads. I met up with a mate. Well, I see him quite a bit, but there was another lad, another old mate who I hadn't seen for ages, and the three of us met up last week, went for some beers, the beer garden. And my mate who'd come over from, he lives on in Europe, and he'd come back over for a break, and we were in the pub in the beer garden, and there was a little sign next to the thing saying cash only. I took a picture of it and put it on Telegram, and I just think that's there's a strange thing about that, because
hold on, it was cards only, wasn't it? It was
card only. You could only pay for a beer with a card. You couldn't get anything with cash. And now this is the thing. Now people have said, well, you know, like the some of them in the sort of anti-technocrat kind of the their top people, they've got this thing where they'll say, well, use cash. You can fight back by using cash. But the problem is, if you go to a pub and it's just like, well, card only, you can't use cash. They'll just not accept it. And my mate was saying, look, I've got cash, but I can't actually buy anything. I can't buy a pint. I've got money in my pocket. I can't buy a pint with it. Now, what I've noticed is the way that the power dynamic shifted. So it used to be, I mean, if I went to the Three Bulls and Newcastle's Haymarket back in the day, like they'd let you pay with whatever you wanted. As long as it was legal tender, you could pay with whatever you wanted. Back then it was just cash, like. But it used to be where if somebody was running a business, as long as they were getting money somehow, they didn't care. But now they do care. Now it's, well, the point is, like, if he'd said, well, okay, either I can pay in cash for my round of beers, or I'm going to walk out, they would have just said, well, sorry, but you're just going to have to walk out. That's policy. And I just, that's amazed me. That kind of flips on its head the idea that people are just in business to make money, the idea that the customer is always right. And all
I was going to say that's another phrase, along with it's a free country. Another phrase that you never hear now is, well, the customer is always right. I don't think young people today, I don't think, have that built into them as a sort of assumption about society. Whereas, again, even 20 years ago, everyone did.
They can do it and they can get away with it. It makes, like, is anybody going bust because of this? Because I don't know if it was a chain. I'm not even sure if it was a chain, but it's, at the end of the day, like I will say, we didn't leave. We just went halves on his round. So maybe everybody just does that, and then the next time you go along, you just make sure that you've got the right card.
Jeez, yeah. So then you're nudged into that desired behavior.
Yeah, you're nudged. You're nudged into it.
I mean, this is the thing. It becomes onerous to resist the policy, whatever the policy is. It becomes more difficult to be a rebel. And of course, people will say, well, you should take the cost. You should be the rebel. Of course you should. The point is that most people won't. And again, you saw this during COVID. I mean, I think a lot of people probably didn't believe that the mask would help, but everyone else is wearing it, so they're going to wear it as well, because no one wants to be... I mean, even people like myself, who, yeah, I'm quite happy being an outsider to the mainstream. It doesn't bother me psychologically. Maybe I'm even primed for it in a certain way. I think a lot of us are. But even me, I don't like being the only guy in the supermarket who's not got a mask on, because I'm thinking, oh, how long is it going to be before some fuckwit says something to me, and then I'll maybe get into an argument and it'll be a nasty interaction. What about the security guard? He's watching me. You know, even I don't like it. So, and I'm using myself as an example here because I know I'm someone who's okay with rebelling to some extent in some way. But even I felt self-conscious, and I think a lot of people did. And if it's like that for us, then what is it like for Joe Normie, who's never defied authority in his life? It's just alien to him to do that. Well, he might think, this mask is a load of bollocks. How is this mask going to help me? How is this mask going to stop a virus? But he'll do it anyway. He'll wear it anyway, and he'll social distance anyway, and he'll lock down anyway, and he'll pay with card anyway. Because that's what everyone else is doing.
Yep. We've got some super chats then. It's getting
yes.
on.
Yes, it is. You're right. You're right. You're right. Okay, so there's entropy. So, right. So, Le Paludi. Oh, yes, I recognize that name from my own Telegram chat. Woz, do you feel closer to Morgoth after his great reveal? But I don't know what that's a reference to, so I can't do
it. I think it means my ancestry, where it turns out that I'm only like 25% Anglo, and the rest is a mixture of Irish, Welsh, and Scottish.
Right. Well, I mean, that's interesting.
I actually contacted Survive the Jive, and I was saying, like, I really didn't expect this, like, it did much Welsh. In me, and it's an interesting thing. And he was saying it's probably related to the Industrial Revolution, where a lot of people from Wales who were already used to mining got shipped up to the northeast because then they started mining the northeast as well and settled there. So that was a kind of a little back and forth we had about it. So there you go.
People
have said you shouldn't. I mean, I am kind of private. I've got reasons why I did that, but. People have said, like, oh, well, now the government's got your DNA or whatever. Look, at the end of the day, like, if the government wants to take you out, they're not going to not do it because, like, they don't have your DNA. governments have been killing people for hundreds of years. They don't need your DNA to carry out a hit on you. You know what I mean? Oh, it was that fucking what's the face? Their mask unwashed. He was like that. we told him two years later, and like Morgoth still hasn't learned that the government can get your DNA to assassinate you or whatever. If the government wants to assassinate me, they're going to do it. Whether or not they've got my DNA means fuck all, you moron.
Yeah, God almighty. I mean, I think he's just addicted to drama. Archie says, how is UNESCO going to bring censorship via the Think Before Sharing campaign? The UN says that some of the most dangerous conspiracy theories mention Soros, the Rothschilds, and Israel. Will it be effective? The Think Before Sharing campaign. Do you know about this?
No, I do. I don't. No, I don't really know.
It was announced about, I think, about a week ago, and it's a joint thing between the European Commission, Twitter, and the World Jewish Congress. So that's an interesting mix there of. Big tech, the European Commission, and old Jewish, what would you call it, ethnocentric campaigning there.
I mean, people, the funny thing about the Soros kind of thing is that it was like organizations like the World Jewish Congress and the ADL who said, like, you can't call George Soros a globalist because that's anti-Semitic. And yet the people who are actually calling George Soros a globalist were kind of lukewarm, kind of centrist types. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And they didn't really think about his Jewishness. That didn't occur to them. And then it's like, oh, he's this globalist. He's setting up all these NGOs to subvert countries. And it was the Jews themselves who came out and said, you can't say that. It's anti-Semitic. It was around about the Trump campaign when they began to say things like talking about globalists as anti-Semitic, when nobody, people in our circles were, but in the mainstream, right, or weren't?
No, this is an interesting thing where they sort of give away their heavy ethnic association with certain things by complaining about people drawing attention to those things. They'll say, oh, you're being anti-Semitic. By talking about corruption in high finance or paedophilia in Hollywood or whatever it is. And then the person who didn't know anything about the Jewish connection with those things is suddenly informed of that unwittingly. It's a very strange thing. Yeah. But of course, you can understand the ADL being paranoid about this and thus making that misstep. I don't know what to say.
The thing about the JQ these days is that kind of everybody kind of knows to a certain degree. You have to if you're on, because everybody's online all the time, and it's like it's a thing. There's a lesbian lives in my street, and I kind of sometimes bump into her when she's walking a dog, and we have a little bit of a chat, and and even she's kind of aware of it. Like she's. This is what I mean about everybody being in their own silos. She's picked up on certain memes of things that's going on, like the great financial reset and stuff, she'll say. And she's into the kind of Maxwell Epstein kind of stuff, you know? I mean, I bet she's all clued up on a Han Hesh death because she's a lesbian and now she's died in mysterious circumstances. And so I bet she's banging on all that as well. Yeah. But anyway, I try and do this thing with people because I'm a real world kind of guy. At the end of the day, I talk to my neighbors, I go for pints and talk to people all the time. And I've got this thing where I kind of slip in like little subversive red pills, but not in a way to startle people or lecture them. And she was bringing it up, the Epstein Island and all of that. It's like I said before on the Arne Hesh stuff, I don't know him that much about all of that, but I said to her, like, it's funny how they're all Jewish, isn't it? Have you ever noticed that? Is it just me or have you noticed that? And she turned on, she went bingo like that. and I thought, oh, I see, oh, you're full of surprises, aren't you?
So there's an outgrowth of anti-Semitic awareness in the Northeast.
Yeah, well, I think it's just a general thing. I don't think it's this closely guarded secret that it used to be, to be honest. That's going to annoy people, like, but it's the truth.
I don't know. I think in general that, as I said, I was talking to someone today who I never thought would be. And he didn't mention the JQ, but he just mentioned he's clearly been immersed in online stuff, and you know he's a normie, or he was. I mean, it was quite surprising to me. So I think there is just in general a growth in awareness about these things. But anyway, the Think Before Sharing campaign. Well, the Think Before Sharing campaign is exactly an attempt to stymie what we've just been talking about. The COVID-19 pandemic has sparked a worrying rise in disinformation and conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories can be dangerous. They often target and discriminate against vulnerable groups, ignore scientific evidence, and polarize society with serious consequences. This needs to stop. A new campaign helps you learn how to identify, debunk, react to, and report on conspiracy theories to prevent their spread. Check out the infographics and social media pack below and help spread the word that facts matter and no one is to blame. Thinking critically and being informed about conspiracy theories is key to challenging them. This UNESCO campaign is implemented jointly with the European Commission, Twitter, and the World Jewish Congress. There you go. That's the Think Before Sharing campaign. Sounds delightful. So, I mean, I think it's just more clumsy nonsense. I don't think it will work, to answer Archie's question. No, I don't think it will be very effective. It's just obvious what it is. It's a damage limitation exercise coming from very powerful sources, very powerful entities. So, okay. Gadius Maximus asks about what are the chances of a stream with certain parties to put to rest a certain conflict or argument that's been raging recently on Telegram. Morgoth, do you want to talk about that? I mean, I feel it's kind of over.
I've got no interest in it, and I've got no interest in that. I think what we do need to do is to kind of, because we need to sort of go forward and think like, okay, so after everything that's happened and the sort of the different events, and look, let's be honest, we got things wrong as well. I paid somebody on Odyssey 1,000 Odyssey credits because I said there'd be digital IDs in I said that they wouldn't. We were not going to get out of this until everyone's got a digital ID, and it didn't happen. So, and somebody was arguing with me comments all the time. He popped up a month or two back and said, "Well," and I was like, "All right, fair cop." Like, he has, I gave him like 1,000. That was the bet, 1,000 Odyssey credits or whatever. So it's a kind of like, okay, so this side got this wrong, this side got that wrong. Where are we in reality? I'll leave it to the chat to decide. Like, are we closer to a social credit system? Are we closer to like the World Health Organization mandating and just owning public health? So the problem really is like, it's not so much about a model where you can predict that by this time this is going to happen and by this time this is going to happen, because I think everybody fucks that up, to be honest. The problem is, which process are we in? Are we one where there is going forward going to be less technocratic NGO digital control over society, or more? And I think, let's be honest, it's more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obvious. I don't see how anyone could deny that. And I'm not saying that, you know, triumphantly. It just seems to be obvious. The things have been established. Infrastructure has been built, and even in a lot of cases, legislation has been written, implemented like that. The World Health Organization, just a few months ago, there was a thing where they now have the ability to declare a pandemic in any country, or in all countries, for that matter. So it's no longer up to the health service of that particular country to declare. It's now the World Health Organization who can do that. Look, so that's an example of the centralization of these powers.
Look, at the end of the day, like the monkeypox thing it's not related to COVID, or it's possibly related to the vaccines and people's immune systems being shot to hell. And yes, it is disgusting, like degenerates who are spreading it around amongst themselves, that's true as well. But it is, you can't help but notice, like, it is just sort of on the back burner that there is another public health issue which requires yet more vaccines. It requires
They could just be quiet about it. There's no reason for the general public to really know about this. It's just a nasty, it could be described in no more dramatic terms than to say there's a nasty STD going around.
It's like, here's the new sort of shitty Boba Fett series for you to watch before the next main movie comes along. Just so you don't forget about the franchise, just to keep it kind of simmering away there.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. Monkeypox is never going to be a general pandemic. It'd be ridiculous. It's not airborne. It affects a specific demographic. So, of course, but the fact that they keep going on about it and amplifying it as if it's something for everyone to that everyone should be worried about, I think that's not really to terrorize the public. It's, as you say, it's to keep the notion in the public's mind of public health and communicable diseases, and the hazard of going around without a mask on, the nightmare of a life without totalitarian control, for want of a better term. To keep people a bit scared, basically.
I will, as far as the stuff about predictions are concerned. I admitted publicly that I got COVID wrong because I had the approach that this was going to be. I mean, I don't want to. This I've said all this before, but basically, I thought, well, in my mind is the common good of our people. So if it has to be where they are locked in their homes to protect them from some deadly virus, then so be it. If it turns out that the virus isn't that dangerous, and in actual fact, it looks like it's a scam by the elites, the globalist elites, and all of these NGOs and whatnot, then I'm opposed to it. And I can turn on a dime because front and center in both scenarios are the common good of the people. And I'll freely admit that I got this wrong, or I got that wrong, or stay with the digital IDs, or the sort of I didn't get the octopus in the vaccines. Like I literally posted that as a joke. I never took that seriously from the beginning. I've got nothing to hate, but I'll tell you what I will never ever back down on is the vaccine and the damage that it's doing, because here we come back to it again. It's a common good of our people, and there's no defense of that vaccine going into young kids, especially when the first signs of things going wrong were young women, girls, even middle-aged women complaining that they were having problems with their periods. That was right there at the start, before even the myocarditis and the strokes and all the rest of it. Now, if you are a nationalist and you are invested in the well-being of your people, and you are seeing young women being forced to take a vaccine, which has already, where you go on Twitter and there's thousands and thousands of them saying, this is really messing up my monthly period. That is a major, major red flag. Anybody who calls themselves a nationalist, there should be fucking red sirens blaring in your head when your women are saying, I've took this vaccine, I've been forced into it, and my menstrual cycle's gone all to hell. That is a fucking code red emergency. And I will never change my mind on that. And it's not for me to answer for that, or the heart attacks, or any other shit that comes down the pipeline.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel the same. I mean, this is an instinctual thing that I from about May 2020, I thought there's something wrong. Really before that as well, but I kept pretty quiet until May. And it was because it was only in May that I really decided, okay, there is, something's definitely wrong here. And I've never regretted it. And certainly when the vaccine, I mean, I thought immediately, because of the numbers, the death numbers just aren't there to justify a vaccine. So that's clearly ridiculous. And then the after effects of the vaccine started appearing. So, I have a clear conscience. Now, yeah, I've got some things wrong. Sure. I'll happily admit, I'll happily own up to that. But the general thrust remains the same, that this has been a massive, at best, this has been a money-grabbing operation on a massive scale. But at worst, it's been the first stages in totalitarian globalist takeover of the world as we know it. So, again, I don't know which it is. Maybe it's both. I think there's a lot of evidence that it is the latter as well as the former. I mean, it's not just the money. I do think it's also the control. I think a new world is being made. And I said this in a Telegram thing the other day. I think a new world is being built around us. Now, whether that job will be completed, whether it will be arrested by truly global events like the war in Russia, the rise of China, I don't know. Maybe they will get Maybe they won't get 2030, or maybe they will. Maybe they'll get it and then it won't last very long. I don't know. But I do think that they want it. And I think that the evidence of the last 2 years demonstrates that. So, yeah, I, in spite of some errors I've made in predictions or whatever, I don't really take predictions seriously because I'm not in that game. I'm not promising anything about that it will happen on this date or on this year or whatever. But in spite of some errors I've made in that regard, my conscience is clear.
I made a video at the beginning of it all, and it's still on my YouTube channel. I've never taken anything down. All the streams are still up. Everything, all my fuck ups are still up there and freely available, and I've made them. I don't deny it. I'm not proud like that. But if I'm wrong, I'll correct myself. But the worst, the one that really makes us cringe, was that I did one at the beginning of it, and it was called like "Will COVID destroy globalism?" And the idea of the video was that because sort of neoliberalism needs the mass sort of transport of goods and people to keep itself running. That's what it does. It's open borders. It's so everything moves around all of the time. All of these products, all of these people, and of course, if you've got lockdowns. And it was kind of like the arteries of globalism were going to be stuffed up. And it may be a chance for nationalists to kind of capitalize on that. Maybe if it was a public health, like a virus was going to do in the system once and for all. And it turned out it's like the complete opposite of what actually happened. But it is what it is. It's there as a historical testament. So that one day when I kind of, you know, one day if somebody can go by and scroll all of my stuff and think, fuck me, he really fucked that up, like, can't he? You know what I mean?
It's
the top 10 worst takes of all time. it's there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was doing my AMAs on YouTube at that time in the first quarter of 2020, and I remember saying in there, people were asking me, so what do you think about this coronavirus thing? Do you think it's going to be a big deal? And I remember saying, oh, no, I don't think it's going to be a big deal. It looks like the death numbers aren't very high. It seems to be mostly old people and all this. And the thing is, I turned out like my prediction was wrong because, of course, they made a huge deal out of it. But the thing is, I was actually correct insofar as they didn't need to make a big deal out of it. It shouldn't have been a big thing. So in that sense, I actually was correct early on, but only by, I'm not claiming any great foresight there. It's just that I think it was clear to a lot of people, like in March 2020, well, hardly anyone's dying from it. It's mostly old people. So it's not a big deal. That's how it should have progressed. And that's why, you know, from the end of March onwards, it was all a bit perverse because it progressed in a strange direction that was not called for, except that the whole thing was basically a trick. Anyway, so let's return to these super chats because I know that time is limited. ABC says, have you seen the movie 22nd July? Some of the dialogue between the characters in that movie seems interesting, doesn't it? Well, I haven't seen it, but I just Googled it, and it's a dramatization of the Anders Breivik killing spree in 2011 in Norway. And it's actually an American film. It's in English. But no, I haven't seen it, so I can't comment on that. Morgoth, have you seen 22nd July?
No, I didn't know it existed.
No, neither did I. I've never heard of it until now. So sorry, we can't comment on that, ABC. Now, Winter Phoenix Forest Karen. Why did the RAF women resign? Why do people resign in protest? We lose a person in a position of power. She should have fought against the anti-whiteness. Well, I think her way of fighting against it was to resign, because if she'd stayed in her post, she wouldn't have been able to fight against it, because she would have been, she'd just have been fired. So at least by resigning, she could make a show of protest, which did. I mean, that has some effect. Probably more effect than if, as I say, she'd stayed in there and not been able to do anything against it. But yeah, that's a sort of ethical dilemma, really. Okay. Trad Dad says, adversity is our strength. And I think that was an hour ago. So I think that was when you were talking about the Antarctica and Scott and so on.
I agree with that, actually. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think so too. Although I am a creature of comfort myself, so I'm not in any illusions about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm somebody who's spent like literal decades of his life in like shit minimum wage jobs, and there's an adversity to that as well, but it's more of a spiritual one, and it's harder to grasp that as well. You know, sometimes the pain and the suffering is just pointless. I think there's different forms of it, but it's something that would have to be sort of thought out a lot more than what I have in the few seconds since I heard that. I think it reminds us of what my dad used to say about, you know, sometimes you think you're working out and you're doing yourself good, but it's just strain. And I think you need, there's a difference where when you endure something and you become stronger for it, and when you endure something like just for the sake of it, just because you have to, and there's no benefit, there's no catharsis at the end of it. I don't think all, I think all of the decades and the years I've spent in shit jobs made me psychologically like nigh on bulletproof. I don't know, but it's an interesting thing that.
Yeah. One thing I would say is that I think working for yourself means that the labor involved is always beneficial insofar as it's always benefiting you directly in theory. Whereas if you're working for someone else, then there isn't a proportional relationship between the effort you put in, how much you get worn out, and the money you get in return for it. So that's just a point that I would make. For what it's worth, I've not worked in factories or manual in that kind of area at all. The nearest to that, which I think isn't entirely irrelevant, is I did dishwashing when I was 17 to 19. And that was often like 10, 12 hour shifts. And it wasn't heavy manual work, of course not, but it was fucking annoying. It was grim. It was something that I did not enjoy, and frankly, I think it was probably stupid of me to ever do that, because it gave me I didn't react well to it. It wasn't a good entree into the world of work.
I used to cycle to work most of the time. Even when I was living abroad, I cycled to work in all weathers, and in the winter, especially, it was a lot of, especially when I was back here. And a lot of the time in the winter, I'd be cycling and it would be dark when I went to work. It would be dark when I came back. And then in the winter, especially when it was snow and slush, and you're cycling along the side of the road and you've got your lights on. But when it was snow, I've been knocked down twice, actually.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, I've been knocked down on a bike. But especially when you're trying to navigate, you know, when the snow, when it's been there for a few days and it gets kind of compacted, and so it becomes really slippery, but it's still proper snow. And it was just this thing where it was like, I've been up for half an hour and I'm facing a potential life or death situation here. Just because I'm cycling through country lanes with lights on my bike on like slippery slow, hoping that these cars speeding past don't ram into the back of this because one of them had too many beers last night and this kind of thing. And you're always on edge. You're always in a kind of state of high alert. Like it's a real problem that you have to deal with, you know what I mean? And that's before you even get to the job, and then you come back and you're exhausted, and there is, I mean, like the fella before said in the super chat, there is that you do feel a sort of inner strength just because of the adversity. You do get that, you do get that toughness, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely true that if a muscle isn't used or a drive isn't challenged, then it will just go to waste. I mean, if you use it, it will strengthen you. That is true. But at the same time, as someone's just said, stress kills. So it is actually quite a delicate thing. Anyway, okay, so there's one last super chat from Jive Turkey. Let me just get this. Right. He says, they're confident about using hard power in North America now, is what I meant to say. So I don't know what he is, because his first super chat seems to be gone. But yeah, they're confident about using hard power in North America now. What would you say to that? I mean, Biden's presidency does seem to be quite different from what's preceded it. I mean, from the start, you know, it's this bizarre. Remember, he was giving his run for presidency, he was always wearing a mask, and then he was giving speeches to empty venues, empty auditoria. And then the inauguration, apparently it was all, I can't remember the arrangements were, but it was like the army and the police. I mean, it looked like it was the imagery of like that was seen in Hollywood films about a fascist dictatorship, where the president is guarded literally by the army from the public. I mean, it was really incredible.
Well, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, basically you've got, I think it was like Moldberg, who takes a lot of crap, but he what he would call a two-story state, which is that you've got different factions because of the way they consume media and because of their values, and you end up getting the problem that we've talked about of where the regime needs to create a truth and a narrative which people can get on board with to one degree or another. And in America, that just does not exist anymore. If you look at, like we mentioned earlier, if you look at, say, if you look at Rocky III or something, you know, you look at Independence Day, these movies that came out in the old day, people would go and see Independence Day, even though it was like really liberal and subversive, and so was Rocky IV or Rocky III, but basically there was something that they could all get behind.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah. Especially the Rocky ones. And you'll find that when you go back into the 80s, which is the era that the kind of centrists lionize, you know, for good reason, because the center was solid. Then what you'll find is that now that doesn't exist. Now everything is politicized. And so it erodes away at the legitimacy of the power system. If only half of the country actually believe that it's legitimate, it can't function. So it has to exert more and more social capital, political capital, and increasingly just outright force to try and shore itself up. And that's what you're seeing. It's a state of collapse. It's the beginning of Caesarism.
Yeah, I mean, in the 80s and 90s, the center, as you say, was solid. Therefore, there was no, and I'm talking in terms of public perception here, there was no need for the far left or the far right. Those were farcical things that kind of idiots got involved with. I think that was the general perception.
Look at the contrast. I'm old enough to remember the Bill Gates, Monica Lewinsky thing. Now, I was young, to be fair, but I remember it being on the television all the time. I remember it was a massive scandal. It just dragged on and on and on. And it was like, what, Bill Gates humped some Jewish secretary. He got a blowjob in the Oval Office or something like that. All right. But then now you've got the situation where, so first of all, that was condemned and it was a massive scandal. Okay, that was. But then you look now and it's like Joe Biden's son is like smoking crack with like Chinese prostitutes, underage prostitutes, and everybody knows it. And the FBI covers it up. It's played down and they raid Trump.
And it has political implications because he's brokering deals with Ukraine and China.
Yeah. So the difference is huge. So, and it comes down to the fact that it's the regime. I wrote a Substack article about this called America's Toxic Rebrand. And the point that I made was that when America was exporting classic liberal values, it was at its peak, let's say in the 80s. And the era of woke, it just doesn't work like that. It's shite. Everybody hates it. It doesn't work. If I was a mullah in Iran, I'd be more fearful of the message being sent by Rocky III than I would be by whatever garbage is coming out now on Netflix or whatever. Yeah. Because it's so obvious that it's subversive messaging. But if you take this idea where the American dream, the American idea of the 80s, which was if you work hard, you stick in there, buddy, just, you know, you'll come out on top. There's a winner. Not everybody can win, but maybe you can be the winner. You know, and there's an individualism and there's capitalism and there's a freedom and there's a liberty baked into that, which appeals universally.
No, it's important to say you don't need to be the winner, because if you look at America in the 50s, a guy with a working class job at the local factory could afford a nice house in suburbia with three kids and his wife working at home. So it doesn't even, you don't even need to be the big shot. It's just, you know, capitalism can make everyone comfy. If not rich and prominent, then definitely comfy. So that's a very inviting notion.
It's universally inviting. The idea that you can stand on your own feet, provide for your family, be free from a tyrannical government, and enjoy life is a fucking hell of a good sell. It really is. And what are they offering now? Like compliance to the trans agenda and white privilege theory? It just makes you want to puke.
And the bugs and the pod.
And then even the rainbow flag is like, you know, there's this like theory where if something is toxic and disgusting, like in nature, it's really brightly colored.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard of this. Yeah. So, I mean, the whole woke stuff, it's stifling, it's suffocating. And it's anti-human, whereas the freedom thing appeals directly to a certain male, well, a key parts of the male psyche, the desire for freedom, the desire for self-sufficiency, the desire to provide for a woman and children. I mean, yeah, that's exciting for the male psyche, whereas the woke stuff is awful for the male psyche. I mean, it explicitly tells you that as a male, you're an oppressor and you're bad and whatever. And then in a thousand little ways, it stifles you. So it's just awful. But again, this brings us back to the issue of what has happened to men around the West, that they put up with this, whereas the Taliban don't, because they've not been they've not been conditioned over 80 years, whereas we have. But as you say, it's something that still even now has to be artificially enforced, and really it's onerous. It's a difficult thing to keep enforcing because, you know, weak though Western men are in this day and age, I honestly believe that if the speech protocols, the behavioral protocols, the woke propaganda, if all of that were abandoned, everything would return to sanity in terms of social relations. Things would return to sanity in a matter of, well, hours. I mean, that's how it's like the thing about civilization. But there's a phrase like any civilization is three meals away from civil war or barbarism. I think you could say a similar thing about the woke thing. It's like it's maybe three propaganda posters away from Conan the Barbarian.
one thing that you can take from the woke stuff, a lesson to be learned that you can't really get from the more classic liberal ideals is power and policy go very, very, very far. I get accused of like just sort of being black-pilled and pessimistic all of the time. I'm not really much of an ideologue because I mainly see that ideology is kind of whimsy unless you have power. So it's all very well to craft out your perfect sort of political philosophy, but unless you have power, it's just piss and wind. And so what we've learned with the woke stuff, which is objective, it's just insane what they're doing. It's insane what they come out with. It's stupid. It's repulsive. It doesn't make any sense. But they can still get it done because they've got power and they've got policy. And what that tells us is that whatever we want to do can be done with power and policy. There's so much. And to be fair, there's a lot of work gone in. We run ourselves down. There's infighting. There's all of this. But at the end of the day, there's been a lot of good work done in recent years studying not so much like racial biology and this kind of thing, which we used to do, but just power and policy and how that works. And what you'll find is that if you have the institutions of power, you can get a lot of shit done. Like we could get a lot done. So the problem is not so much ideology, but power. The problem of power, and it presents it. How do you undermine it? How can you beat it? Is there a novel, different way to remove power from the center of power and give it back to the people, for example, which I find a very, just the idea of sovereignty, which sounds kind of gay and liberal, but when you think about it, if the people were empowered and they actually got what they voted for, this kind of shit wouldn't be happening. By and large, there'd be some outliers, but you'd be in a better place. And so one of the lessons that we've learned is that if you can implement a policy and then it'll trickle down through the institutions once you've purged all the arseholes, and you can get things done. You can make a change. And by and large, the normies that you see wandering around, they won't resist. We've learned this now. They won't resist. So if you want to start implementing policies, which are, and another thing to learn is this kind of managerial bureaucratic language. So if you wanted to put policies which offered incentives to, a bit of a joke one would be an incentive to escape white oppression, which is positive sounding. That's great. I'm going to get an incentive to escape my white oppressors. It's about bloody time. But what it means is you're getting a one-way ticket back to Africa.
Yeah. There's all this. All it's how you sell it, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And once the policy is there, it's just a matter of implementation. So you bring in a think tank and you bring in a PR department. How can we sell it? How can we get it done? How can we nudge them? How can we apply psychology them and all of this kind of thing?
Yeah.
The problem is power.
Yes. I completely agree. I mean, I think this has been made very clear over the last 2.5 years that it's ultimately all about power. I mean, the ideology is secondary in terms of priorities. The first thing you need is to build a power base. There's one closing thing from the same guy, Jive Turkey. He says, the more incompetent, I think he was talking about the woke regime and Biden and whatever, the more incompetent and illegitimate the regime becomes, the more ham-fisted the tactics they use to maintain control. But that almost always backfires. We just don't know when. So that's a nice open-minded note to end on, I guess. Morgoth, do you have anything to say about that?
Sorry, what was that again?
Well, he's saying that the more incompetent and illegitimate they become, the more ham-fisted and heavy-handed they have to be in order to maintain control. And that almost always backfires.
Absolutely. And they are becoming retarded. They are making mistakes. It's one thing to run. You know, when we were talking about Scott of the Antarctic before, and there's this tendency where you think, I mean, look, let's admit it. Like, they all had balls of steel. They were highly competent, highly well-read, like great men. And they did amazing things. And it's tempting to like compare ourselves to that and think, oh God, we're such degenerate losers. You know what I mean? The problem is that there may be some truth to that. You know, it's something to get into, but the thing is, it's affecting also the elites. Now, you can go back. You can go back and look at a political debate, even just in the 1990s, even just in the 1990s or the 1980s, and you can see the stamp of the elites then compared to what we've got now, and they are retarded. And the people who are working in the bureaucracy are retarded. The people who are running, even the people at the top, are increasingly retarded. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing all of this retarded stuff they're doing now. As I say, if you want to have a successful American foreign policy, you do it on that old-fashioned liberalism. Or you do it on that, as EA was saying about the when Biden was about to win, the going back to French Fresh Prince. And what he meant was, if you then sort of, they've got their guy into office, you know, and then what you do is you normalize things. You take out the poison. You get people back off to sleep. You get people thinking they're safe. They're too stupid. It's not that, in a way, they're too stupid to do that now. It's the elite itself is degenerating. Joe Biden's the perfect example of it. He's a potato. Yes. And so, compare Joe Biden to Bill Clinton in the 90s. Look how charismatic and kind of suave Bill Clinton was. He wasn't even this kind of sort of WASP upper class figure. He was more just like some kind of swaggering Southern Chad with a bit of a wink, you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, it kind of worked. But whereas Joe Biden's just this senile cabbage, and it's like this degeneration. Now, the problem with that is that you've got retards in charge. You get the Lenny from Mice and Men scenario, where you've got, like, you know, like it's like the 6-year-old boy who's like pointing a shotgun at you. That's the scenario we're heading into in many ways. So you get through that. So this is why you see all these stupid policies, like the IRS are going to go and raid everybody in these red states, or the RAF won't take on white men. That's not smart.
No, it's not. It's baking incompetence and dysfunction into the very system that they rely upon. It's mental.
What it tells me is that sneak your way into the bureaucracy if you're a young lad. Why not get a career in some of these institutions? Keep your head down, see what's going on, and gain more power. I'm like a sort of middle-aged fart at this day. You know, that's too late for me. But there you go. What's great about it, if you study the power and think, okay, I know what my core ideals are. I know what kind of things I want to see happening. And I'm going to get a little bit of power. Even if you're just going onto the local council, what's happening at the local council? I've been involved in a very boring and banal way. I actually know what's happening in my local council, who the players are and what their kind of takes on things like that, in a really boring way. You know, get into that, have a look at it, because I'll tell you what, this climate change shit and all the rest of it that's coming in, the weakest that they are weak at the local level. Because at the end of the day, they need it to come down. They need it to trickle down. It's coming from very, very far on high. And there's this kind of trickle-down process. And the sort of the basic level where the local MP kind of faces with the public is where it's turned out time and time again. It's weak there. You know, it's like this little kind of weak joint that they've got.
Yes, they have to rely on. I mean, this is what Mark Malone was saying.
About he's had wins.
Well, I mean, I haven't kept up with that because it's an American thing, but I wasn't sure because he was saying that it's a similar thing in Britain, and it's interesting for sure.
It's interesting because it used to be where we'll form a base political party and we're gonna we'll red pill the normies, we'll have a party, we'll take power, and then that'll be that. Well, unfortunately, they can see that coming a mile off. What they can't see coming is where people have now been exposed. People who watch the content, like the kind of content we're doing now, are also like oftentimes familiar with Carl Schmitt. You know what I mean? And the average viewer of dissident right content in 2022 has a higher grasp of Machiavellian power politics than people in universities.
And yes, I would say
informally going in at the local level, low key, and just figuring out how this shit works. You don't have to go in there and start talking about bloody, you know, the
USS Liberty or something.
Yeah, well, you just it's just to see how the process of power works. Study it and then start and implement it and use it and bend it.
Yeah. All right, well, we should wrap it up there. But while we've been talking, something has happened in Russia, which I think I should mention. Alexander Dugin appears to have been targeted an assassination attempt. And by chance, he wasn't in the car with his daughter, who was driving. But the car seems to have exploded anyway, and it's killed his daughter. So Alexander Dugin nearly died tonight.
Wow.
In Moscow, wow. Yeah. Or Moscow Oblast. So that's just something that's been going on. I mean, things never stop. Remarkable.
No, yeah, there you go. I mean, yeah, that's. It seems a pretty shitty thing to do. His daughter didn't do anything wrong, did she?
No, but I think that the target was him.
Yeah, the target. Yeah.
They were driving back. He was supposed to be in the car with her, but he seems to have taken, for some reason at the last minute, he didn't get in the car. And then she drove off, and it's now exploded. And she's dead.
It'll be interesting to see who gets blamed for that, because my impression was that he was kind of on the outs because of some extreme things he'd said about Ukraine. That said, I mean, we're wrapping up, but I'll have a big hour-long Spengler video up tomorrow looking at some of the other civilizations that he covers, including Russia, which is his next, which he viewed as the civilization of the future. And I'll give some little takes and depth on that in my video, which will go up tomorrow night.
Excellent. Well, I think people will the links will be shared to your channel. I'm sure most people will know how to find you. You're on Odyssey and Telegram and Substack.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, let's end it there because I'm exhausted now. We've gone for an hour and 20 minutes longer than we were supposed to go for, but I think that's probably okay. I haven't received any messages flailing around asking me to stop, so I think we're all right. All right, so just to remind everyone, I'm Millennial Woes. I'll be doing Millennial in a few months from now. I hope Morgoth will appear then. In the meantime, I do a weekly show on Telegram, Gram of Woes, which gets uploaded to Odyssey. And this has been fun. This has been a one-off, but just covering for Greg. So I've enjoyed this. Morgoth, thank you for agreeing to be my guest.
No problem. And I'll probably say Millennial at this point, like, unless you pop on for a Morgcast between then. But otherwise, I'll see you at Millennial.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it. All right. Thank you, Morgoth, and thank you to everyone for the super chats and for the commentary along the way. Hope you enjoyed this.
Thanks for tuning in, folks, and I'll catch you later.
Okay, and I'll catch you later too. Bye-bye.